Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Y'all ready for this?
I'm ready.
Hello, everyone. Eventually, I'm going to stop singing along with our theme song, but it just never gets old. Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Right? I mean, it's a really good song. Here with me while Kai is out, you just heard, is Amy Scott once more. Amy.
Hey, everybody.
Thanks for coming back. Marketplace's senior correspondent covering housing and the economy. And Jill of all trades. Utility infielder.
I'm surprised you had me back, frankly. But thank you.
No, are you kidding? Yesterday was so fun. And today is actually a topic that is near and dear to both of our hearts, wildfire.
Absolutely.
And where we live. Yeah, exactly. So it's Tuesday. This will be our deep dive into a single topic.
Because housing, where and how we build homes, is one of the reasons wildfires have gotten bigger and more damaging and more deadly. So what do we do about that?
Yep, exactly. Making us smart on this today is Kimiko Barrett, a wildfire researcher at Headwaters Economics, which is a nonprofit research group. Kimiko, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for allowing me on.
So what do we mean? I'll kick us off here. When we say, it seems like a big part of what's happening is that we are increasingly building housing in places that burn, and it's known as wildland urban interface, right? What is that, and why are we talking about it now?
Good questions. So the wildland-urban interface, known by the lovely acronym of WUI, is this landscape.
Oh, that's how you say it. WUI.
WUI. Isn't that just such a lovely, attractive acronym? But what we are referencing there is this landscape where the built and unbuilt environment meet up. So effectively where structures and homes are starting to interface with forests, grasslands, and wildland vegetation. This, unsurprisingly, is also one of the more appealing places to want to live and build homes. So recreationally, scenically, they're beautiful areas most often. And so this has driven up wildfire risks because as home development increases in these places, obviously you have more structures exposed to wildfires. In fact, the WUI is the fastest growing land use type in the country, and a recent study indicated that now more than a third of all homes are located in these wildfire prone lands, again, largely referenced as the WUI.
And so when developers look at the equation of where to build, how much does the risk factor in? And do you think the result of the last several years of increasingly dangerous and deadly fires is making them sort of reconsider?
Yeah, I think we're forced to at this point. We're seeing wildfires at such a catastrophic level that we need to very deliberately start thinking about how, where, and under what conditions homes are allowed to be built in these places like the WUI. It's complex though, right? As all of these climactic hazards are, and it varies quite widely between place to place. Places like California has a huge housing pressure, particularly when it comes to where affordable housing can go. And so, you know, sometimes they have no choice but to go up into these landscapes. Alternatively, places like where I live here in Montana, it's not as complicated. A lot of the pressure in these more wildfire-prone lands comes from people who are wanting more of a retreat or an amenity location. And so, you know, it factors in differently into how and where they build. They can play with different options because it's not the same kind of housing pressure that places like California are facing. So whether developers factor this in or not, I think it's starting to come to the forefront, particularly when you involve the role of insurance and others that may or may not provide, you know, coverage for those places that are at such high risk.
Right, because it's getting harder and more expensive to get that insurance.
Yeah, that's a huge... Do you think that... Okay, I'm a little off track here because I want to ask about that because it's so interesting. Do you think that will start to... I mean, hold on. It seems like the problem is they're just... the houses in places that maybe aren't as fire-prone, that are more urban, are too expensive. So I can't imagine that insurance pressure alone is going to stop development in these areas, right?
No, I wouldn't think so either. And until very recently, insurance hasn't really played a large role because wildfire claims have not been as substantial as, say, flooding or hurricanes or leaking washing machines even, or hail damage. All of those have significantly outweighed what wildfire costs and premiums have come to up until recent years. So wildfire and insurance have not really had a relationship strong enough to compel people to build or not build in certain areas. I think the other big piece that you have to factor in is when you're looking at the cost of wildfire and who actually pays for those suppression costs. And by suppression, I'm talking firefighting efforts to contain and extinguish a wildfire. That comes largely from the federal government. So that's taxpayers coming to pay for a lot of those costs to protect homes that are built in wildfire-prone lands through the Forest Service and other land management agencies. At the local level, there's not a lot of incentive, therefore, for an elected official to not approve of a development in a wildfire-prone area when all that's going to do is increase their property and tax revenue. So you see, there's a moral hazard there, and there's a reversed fiscal incentive in who's actually paying for the cost of suppression in contrast to who's getting the property revenue from it. And we've shown through our research that there's actually a lot of secondary costs that come from wildfire that comes months and years that are borne at that local level. But they're often overlooked when you're calculating who pays for wildfire. And so, you know, again, there's just not a lot of incentive at that local level to not approve of developments.
Given the increase in just the sheer number of people living in these wooey zones, wildland-urban interface zones, how has that changed how we approach wildfire forest management and wildfire suppression?
Sure. There's a lot of work and effort now being done at that federal level to work on both equations of the built as well as the unbuilt environment. Much more is focused on the unbuilt. So managing forests through treatment projects, prescribed burns, mechanical thinning, other efforts that focus largely on the forest. The other side of that, though, that we really push for through Headwaters Economics and other community-based efforts is to look at the built environment as well. So to factor in the urban within that wildland urban interface. And so by that, it's a very intentional effort to think how you plan a home, a neighborhood, and a community to live with the inevitability of a wildfire. Because wildfires are only going to increase, we know this. And they're a natural process within our ecological systems. Our forests and our grasslands depend on fire. Native Americans have used fire for centuries. And so we know that they're inevitable. We know that they're also going to increase with all these converging trends. So given that, we need to very thoughtfully and anticipatorily think about how we plan our communities to live with that risk.
What does that look like? Like more prescribed burns or other kinds of resilience?
It's a combination of everything. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's again, with all climactic hazards, we have to use and deploy everything we have at our disposal. So that involves looking at the unbuilt environment as the agencies are currently doing, using forest treatments, prescribed burns, looking at where we can start to very thoughtfully minimize those fuels and those risks, and then looking at the built environment. And so that, again, requires a very forward-looking perspective of how you design a community to live with wildfire. And so that implies things like making sure there's adequate access for emergency vehicles as well as evacuation, making homes perhaps not be able to 100% survive a wildfire, but certainly to tolerate and withstand it so that it can stand with smoke damage. So that's looking at the building products within a home, how the landscape around it is treated, the vegetation involved in it. It's looking at things like adequate water supply and trying to build a community that can ultimately withstand a wildfire and reduce the chances of an actual disaster occurring. And we're doing this with all climactic hazards at this point. We do it with flood planning and mitigation. We're doing it with sea level rise and storm surge, with hurricanes, with earthquakes. And so we know that we're going to have to start thinking about how we build differently. And we have that engineering and that science to know how to do things better. It's just, as with all things, very complicated. And in some ways, it can be more expensive when you're talking about what kind of materials are involved. So these are all things that have to get factored in, and trying to make it affordable for everyone who's going to have to start building to higher wildfire-prone standards.
Yeah, I did some reporting on that a couple of years ago. Visited a home outside Boulder, Colorado, that had been rebuilt after being destroyed in a fire. And it did add a certain percentage to the cost. I can't remember off the top of my head, but this was a wealthy couple that were able to rebuild. But the materials and the architectural design, all that stuff is more expensive, right?
It can be. You have to factor in other things too, though, where we've done a study here through Headwaters Economics, working with the community to actually calculate what those costs were. And what we found is that when you total it all up, it can be negotiable, because what happens for, say, a metal roof, which can be quite more expensive, you replace it with siding that's actually a lot cheaper than standard cedar siding. And so they can negate each other if you actually use all of those wildfire-resistant materials in upgrade or rebuilding of a home. There's also a durability consideration. For example, rock mulch is a lot longer and it's a lot easier to maintain than wood mulches. So it's things like that that actually, when you start to factor it in, the cost can be more negotiable depending on where you are. And so our study was here for Southwest Montana. And what we found is that by using certain products over traditional building combustible materials, it was affordable for most homeowners. But again, that does vary with place to place and what the supply and demand is.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I want to wrap up here. We had this listener question last week, Wednesday, for our weekly episode called What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? And a listener asked, you know, basically, whose door do I have to knock on, or I'm going to ad lib kick in, to get better fire management? You know, whose job is this, Kimiko? How would you answer that question?
Oh, wow. You know, fire management is such a big concept to think about. I think it's everybody's job. I think homeowners that are living in places that are at wildfire risk have a level of responsibility in maintaining their property and their structure to reduce risks, not just for their own safety and that of their neighbors, but for firefighters, and to give those firefighters an extra chance and more time to be able to protect their home. And so by that, I'm talking about vegetation management, clearing your gutters from dead debris or your roofing, looking at what kind of plants you have around your home or the shrubbery up against your home, trying to reduce all opportunities for ignition to happen from a flying ember or some other source of a wildfire. So there's a role for the homeowner to play, certainly. And then with that, it's larger organizations moving up, such as homeowner associations, it's elected officials. It expands the entire spectrum of fire management involvement from the local level all the way up to the federal level. The Forest Service is only able to do so much, and there's such a vast area that needs to be treated that they'll never be able to get to it. So that requires a shift in our perspective as a society in terms of how we expect firefighters to play that role of protecting homes and communities, keeping in mind that wildfires are the only hazard that we as a society expect to be protected from. We don't expect people to go in harm's way to save us from a flood or from a hurricane, and yet we have this expectation that firefighters are going to do that for us. And so we have to shift that thinking, because with the extreme wildfires that are occurring and their increase into the future, that's no longer a reasonable expectation. And it puts too many people in harm's way. So everybody needs to start thinking about what their role is with reducing fire risk.
Fascinating.
All right. Kimiko Barrett is wildfire researcher at Headwaters Economics, a nonprofit research group. Thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Kimiko, thanks. Take good care.
You as well. Bye-bye.
So it sounds kind of
that
like...
That is so interesting.
We need to accept some degree of property damage, even, you know, destruction, if we're going to keep living in these areas. And frankly, where are people going to go? I mean, we have a huge shortage of housing for sale, available housing. You know, that's where people want to live. I don't blame them. I want to have a house in the woods.
Yep, exactly. And in Northern California, it's interesting because a lot of the wooies, I'm sort of sorry that we have to say that, but a lot of the wooies aren't necessarily even in the forest. They're in grasslands. They're in like big, wide open areas with lots of sort of like dry grass around. It is really, so Kimiko's research, I looked up some of it while we were talking, finds that from 2000 to 2019, nearly 2,000 U.S. communities were threatened by wildfires or potential ember spread. 9 cities with 500,000 residents or more were threatened.
Yeah.
And I just think she made such an interesting point about how we expect to be protected from that when it is a totally natural occurrence that is exacerbated by humans, right? 80% of fires are sparked by humans.
Yep. And all these decades of suppression to protect property has just made it worse. When there is a fire, it's that much more calamitous.
Yep. I will say in Oakland, there is a heavy burden on, because we had some pretty devastating fires in, so in 89 and 91, there was an earthquake and a horrible fire.
Oh, yeah.
I think the fires were 91 and I think the earthquake was 89. I always get them mixed up, but people are just scarred from it. And so are the Oakland Hills. But the burden on homeowners is very high. You get like fire inspections every year and a $400 fine if you don't have, you know, all the brush and gutters and things like that cleared away. And they've only stepped that up in recent years, which I think is really interesting. All right. We are headed to a break. Before we go, send us your comments, your thoughts on today's show, do you live in a fire zone? And how much work do you have to do to keep it going? And I do want to say I got an email from someone I know in the Bay Area who sort of felt like we were saying that no fire suppression ever happened. And that is not, or no prescribed burning ever happened. Obviously, some of it happens, but clearly not enough. Send us your thoughts. Okay. Make me smart. At marketplace.org in an email or a voice memo, and we'll be right back.
All right, time for the news fix. Molly, what you got?
Hat tip to Erica Phillips, who finds all the interesting stories on the internet. But this is actually just really relevant, I think, to our conversation today. Specifically the housing part, right? Which is that as basically the whole West Coast has been engulfed in flame over the past few weeks, what you're finding is that a lot of people who had left the Bay Area to escape the high housing costs thinking and gone to Oregon to try to find cheaper housing are now finding that their cheaper housing is burned down. They're finding themselves homeless or displaced. And, you know, I mean, the amount of homelessness that's going to be increased by the combination of the pandemic and these fires is almost unfathomable. And this is just like a particularly heartbreaking factor, which is, you know, a ton of people. There has just really been an exodus in the past like 10, 20 years of people going to Oregon and Washington to try to find cheaper housing.
And Colorado.
And then being...
And Idaho.
And Colorado.
Basically everywhere they can go. And yeah, nowhere is really safe from this risk.
Yeah,
I think about just all the climate refugees that we're going to be seeing in the future. Turns out Baltimore is a relatively good place to be right now. Who knew?
Really? Well, yeah, I know. No, it is really interesting. I think there's going to be... You're starting to see cities like make the list, right, of least impacted by climate change and probably start to sort of attempt to attract people to live there
and
based
market,
on that.
Yeah. Well, my husband says that when he, you know, tries to console me because I'm a Westerner. You know, I grew up in Colorado in the mountains and that's my home. Basically, everyone I love has been affected by the fires in recent weeks and years. And that's one thing that we don't have here is wildfires, at least not yet.
Yeah. Yeah. But wildfires, like everything else in this country, in many, many ways, it's a housing story.
Absolutely. And I brought you a housing story as well.
Yes.
No surprise. So the headline kind of says it all. It is gig economy company launches Uber, but for evicting people, which it's a Vice News story about a company called Civil. That's spelled C-I-V-V-L. And it's basically a platform that connects landlords and property managers with gig workers to help them evict people. On their website, they call it the fastest growing money making gig due to COVID-19.
Yeah.
And so.
Yep.
I mean, it really says everything about this
everything.
Moment we're in. They're advertising all around the country for people to serve eviction notices, clean out foreclosures, assist with removing people from their homes. You know, their Craigslist ad here says earn up to $125 an hour. I mean, you may be wondering, well, isn't there a national moratorium on evictions right now from the CDC?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there is, but tenants have to meet certain requirements to prove or basically attest that they have been affected by COVID, that they can't work. If they were to be evicted, they would become homeless. And there are ways around this. So there is still a business for people, you know, evicting tenants.
Yeah, apparently a pretty booming one. Yeah, it is gross. This has made the rounds all across the internet, and people are appalled by it. And at the same time, there are people who are out of work, and at some point,
yeah,
they're going to be looking for the work that's available. I mean, it's a whole series of upsetting market forces, I think.
Yeah, and there are lots of companies that help landlords evict people. It's a grisly business to be in. But, you know, there are landlords and property owners who have bills to pay. And if they have tenants who aren't paying, you know, they have an incentive to try to get someone else in there. I think the big question right now is, well, who's coming in behind these folks that you're evicting mm-hmm. with so many people out of work? You know, maybe you're lucky to have a tenant that you can keep in the apartment and work out a payment plan with and hope that things get better.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I am as appalled by anybody by the fact that a company like this exists, needs to, but I'm more appalled that it needs to exist, right? I mean, I think like this is a hate the player and the game kind of situation.
Yeah.
We have not protected people in this country.
Yep.
And we're seeing the effects of that. And this is exactly a sadly predictable effect of that. All right. That is it for the news fix. Let's go to the mailbag.
News team.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Our favorite. All right. So last week we did our show, of course, all about what COVID is doing to women's careers. It is not good. We had even more letters from women listeners who have had to leave the workforce. Abby O in Raleigh, Melissa Diaz in New York City. We unfortunately have a whole list. Thank you for writing in about this. Of course, this has me and many people, I think, thinking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, because so much of her career was about fighting for more equality for women in the workplace. We got this letter from, just side note, did you read Nina Totenberg's absolutely amazing obituary?
I heard the radio version. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was
fantastic.
Moving.
And I know this was in her bio too, but one of the things that I thought was so interesting about Ruth Bader Ginsburg is that as she was fighting so many of those cases early in her career before she made it to the Supreme Court, that she had this very deliberate strategy, because her goal was to win these cases, to represent men.
Yeah.
And represent men specifically in Social Security cases, because that was just sort of it was very easy to see the unfairness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Loved that. Loved
she
it.
Was in front of 9 male justices and would have a case involving a yep. widower wanting the same rights. Brilliant.
Yep,
and also,
exactly.
I think, you know, as much as she fought for equality for women, it was really equality between the sexes so that mm-hmm. men and women both benefited.
Right. Which I think is a good way to frame it. Anyway, we got this letter from Marcia Myers, Emeritus Professor of Social Work and Public Affairs at the University of Washington. And she says she's retired by now, but she says she finds herself, quote, often completely exasperated by news and talking heads in popular media that are so clueless about the social, economic, and political roots of the newly rediscovered crises of family care, work, and women's access to equal employment opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, don't call it a comeback. It's been here for years. Yeah. This is just laid
exactly.
bare what many of us have. Yeah. I get
mm-hmm.
it.
I nailed
it. So it's also interesting, you know, when family leave policies do exist, again, it benefits both men and women in the workforce. We heard from Jennifer Devlin in San Francisco, who says 3 of the 4 people I know, small numbers, who are taking advantage of extensive family leave policies in my company are men. Women are a significant percentage of our leadership. I remember complaining. This is me now, not quoting. I remember complaining to a male colleague who had a new baby and wasn't taking leave. I was like, look, dude, you got to take your leave. You got to do it for all of us. Don't make it be just the women. So I'm glad to hear men are taking advantage of that as well.
I am too. And listen, like, we beat up men in that episode for sure. But the fact is that the men I know, there's so many layers of culture to this, you know? And I know men who will just say the expectation is different. And I will be looked at differently if I take all this leave or if I schedule, you know, kid time on my calendar. And all of the men I know who are saying that work for men, like are in you know, more old school industries or old school companies where the permission structure is not there. And that is a big part of it. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. We also heard from Sarah Wood in Colorado, who wrote in about another downside when a company doesn't have a great plan for getting through this pandemic. She said her company has been flexible with working parents, but she writes, quote, as a single woman and a contract worker, I'm finding all the slack is falling to folks like me. Our business has tripled this year and there have been no new hires. I am also at the end of my rope, which is also a fair point.
So I take it Sarah does not have children.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah,
and
so
is feeling
right.
Like,
and I think about that with my young colleagues who are, you know, I have 2 kids. They've been super helpful picking up some of the slack and saying that they're happy to do so. But I think that does take a toll and it again shifts the onus onto individuals and away from the system.
Right. It does. I mean, it's similar to the point we were saying about civil, where it's sort of like that you got to hate the player and the game. Nobody should be having their workload doubled, right? Parents' workloads have doubled if their kids are at home. And then single people who are taking on the extra work at work, their workloads have doubled too. All of that is bad.
Yeah. Lastly, a listener in New York sent us this voice memo after learning that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died.
My name is Fandi. It's almost 2 in the morning, just a few hours after news broke that Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. Can't fall asleep. Feeling anxious, feeling scared. Anyway, let me just start off by saying that I'm an immigrant. And I'm amazed by how Americans revere their justices. It seems like the level of civil discourse among Americans is pretty high, to the point that Americans can find people with quote-unquote boring jobs and make an icon out of them. Of course, being a Supreme Court justice is the least boring form of those boring jobs. I just don't think I could ever see something like that happening in my home country, Indonesia. At least not anytime soon.
Yeah. You know, I just found that fascinating because I would not have thought of Americans as revering people in civic life.
But, I know. I think that's interesting. Not all of them.
Not all of them. And not every Supreme Court justice gets T-shirts and merch, you know.
Right. Exactly.
RBG was special in that way.
Yeah, I think so, too. Also, let's be real. We're like a celebrity culture. It's kind of it's kind of our jam, for good or for ill.
Yeah. But remember, Alan Greenspan was kind of like that. He was like a pop hero before.
He was. It's really true.
Everything went sour.
So weird. So weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to return to boring, you know, boring civil servant situations. All right,
too.
Now this is the part of the show where we play an answer to the Make Me Smart question. Today's answer is from Gretchen Goldman, the research director for the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Gretchen is on today because she's the one I mentioned last week who tweeted out the CNN interview behind the scenes photo that I believe on Twitter I called the most heroic-ish I had seen all day, which was like, you know, up top. Blazer looking super professional, behind her just like sea of toys and life and like underwear and Keens.
Yeah. And I think she was either in her underwear or very short shorts. Yeah. It said everything, really.
Exactly. And then she had this incredible like follow up, you know, Twitter thread about how hard this is for working moms, how hard it is for scientists and women in the STEM field where it's already hard. And so our producer, Rose, got her on the phone. Said, what is your answer to the question? What is something you thought you knew, but later realized you were wrong about?
I used to think that science speaks for itself. That as a scientist, I could present the facts and that was enough. I now know, after years of studying how science is used and misused by governments and corporations, that science doesn't benefit the world unless we make sure it does. By getting it into the hands of those who need it most, ensuring it's conducted ethically, and that it's shared equitably. Science is objective, it's robust, it's careful, but it doesn't tell us what our values should be. Science is a deeply human endeavor, and we shouldn't deny that.
I mean, how great is that?
Yeah, that's great.
Yep. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And then we will leave you. We're having like a Make Me Smile on a Tuesday. We are going to leave you with a voice memo that made me smart. This is responding to the show we did on Friday, where I thanked heartily the bloggess for her list of like all the cute Instagram and TikTok videos of animals. One in particular. Here we go.
This is Casey from New York. I just finished listening to the podcast where Rima and Molly talk about the TikTok chihuahua who cries when it begs for food. As a veterinarian, I just wanted to tell you this is in fact a real thing. This happens when dogs that have chronic dry eyes have a surgery to move their salivary gland duct to their eyeball. So it keeps their eye moist. Whenever they get hungry and they salivate, they are producing essentially saliva in their eyeball. Thanks for all your hard work on the show. Keep it up.
Is amazing.
That's
expertise,
amazing
people. It's so underrated.
Really? Like, also, could there be a better example of how science is a deeply human endeavor?
Exactly.
She's like, oh, I have this
science for the win.
Scientific
really
answer
amazing.
To why a chihuahua can make itself cry when it's begging for food. I mean, come on. This
Thank
is why
you,
I love our
Casey.
Show.
That seriously made my day.
I know. None of us
that
is as
sadly
smart as
is
all
it
of us.
For today's show. Don't forget to send us your questions for tomorrow to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line, questions.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Rose Conlon. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ben Hethcote produces video with the help of wah, 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 our video intern, Ethan Parrott. I'm never going to stop.
I need the story
Eventually,
behind
I'll
that.
Stop. And Erica Phillips. I know I'll explain it after the show. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker skill. Our Make Me Smart speaker skill. Dang it. Nope, still can't do it.
You almost got it. Today's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, and the executive director of On Demand is Sitara Nieves.
Make Me Smart, smart speaker skill. But you gotta say it fast.
Nailed
That's
it.
The key.
Make Me Smart. smart speakers.
Right?
That was
awesome.
Was
You're like, make
you
me smart. No. Just pretty much no. It's impossible.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.